Now we want to go into the 24th chapter. And this 24th chapter is an altogether different prophecy. It is a prophecy telling about the destruction of Jerusalem. And it no doubt, as we study this thing in depth, it no doubt is a prophecy about the destruction of Jerusalem by the Babylonians, and the telling of the time in which the inhabitants of Jerusalem and the land of Judea would be carried into captivity by Babylonia. Now, we just learned about this captivity about Tyre in the 23rd chapter. Now, we're going to see it in the 24th chapter about Jerusalem. Now, Jerusalem is, of course, God's people. Tyre was a wicked city, and they didn't have the true God. They worshipped idols. But Jerusalem was a different story. And actually, we have the next four chapters, 24, 25, 26, and 27, that relate to this same prophecy. They're really all a part of the same prophecy. But each chapter tells a little different facet of it, and it really wasn't even necessary to break this prophecy into chapters, except for the fact that it would have been unduly long if it hadn't been put into chapters. And the first 12 verses now are telling about the calamities that would come upon the whole land of Judea during this invasion and capture and carrying away of the people by Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonian power. So beginning with the first verse, "Behold, the Lord maketh the earth empty, and maketh it waste, and turneth it upside down, and scattereth abroad the inhabitants thereof." Now this word here for earth, "the Lord maketh the earth empty," really, in other places, it's translated as land, and it is a proper term used to describe the land of Judea, or even the city of Jerusalem. Now, he maketh the earth empty. When you make something empty, that means that you have removed the contents that it formerly held. You took those contents out of it, and you made it empty. And so he maketh it waste, and turneth it upside down, and scattereth abroad the inhabitants thereof. It's as though he had a basket with something in it, and he took the basket and just turned it upside down and just scattered whatever was in the basket and emptied it out and made it of no benefit so far as having contents. "Scattereth abroad the inhabitants thereof." Now, this is, of course, exactly what did happen whenever these people were captured by the Babylonians. They were hauled away into captivity into a distant land, a land that they'd never been to before, which was a foreign place for them, and they were kept there for 70 years. Now, you know, if we today were carried away into a land for 70 years, the majority of us in this room would never hope to get out of there because we're not going to live long enough to live past 70 years. So many of these people never got back to their homeland. And it was their offspring then that would be coming back in their place, not them. A person who is 20 today, if he stayed gone 70 years, would be 90 before he'd get back, and he wouldn't be old enough, wouldn't be enough time in his life left to really do any living after he got back. "And it shall be, as with the people, so with the priest; as with the servant, so with his master; as with the maid, so with her mistress; as with the buyer, so with the seller; as with the lender, so with the borrower; as with the taker of usury, so with the giver of usury to him." Now what he's saying here is that this Babylonian captivity and this tremendous destruction and invasion would be no respecter of persons. You could be high or you could be low, and you're all going to suffer devastation the same. And you know, we've seen this in most wars. If, for example, the city of Hamilton were to be attacked tonight by the warfare that's commonly made in nations today, there would be no respecter of persons. If it were bombs, all houses would be equally destroyed. All persons would have the same susceptibility to whatever warfare might be rendered. And so it would simply mean that everybody would be made equal. Excuse me just a minute. Factor of persons, whether it be the priest or the people, whether it be the servant or his master, or the maid or a mistress, or the buyer or the seller, or the lender or the borrower, or the taker of usury and the one who gives usury. Now, the law really didn't provide for them to pay interest or usury. That was really against the law, but apparently the practice was common enough, which would have been a violation of the law, that he does mention it here. And verse 3, the land shall be utterly emptied and utterly spoiled, for the Lord has spoken this word. Now he's just restating in verse 3 what he said in verse 1. This land is going to be emptied. If you think that the Lord is going to be slack in this prophecy, if you think that he's really not going to bring this about, he's just restating it, that the land shall be utterly emptied and utterly spoiled, for the Lord has spoken this word. And verse 4, the earth mourneth and fadeth away. The world languisheth and fadeth away. The haughty people of the earth do languish. This phrase, the earth mourneth and fadeth away, is really a descriptive phrase like a flower, as though a flower might be in full bloom and appear to be so healthy, but after a period of time, it begins to fade. It begins to lose its vitality and its life, and it starts fading away. And that's what he says the earth will do, speaking of this country, this land, this area. The world languisheth. Now, to languish means to become weak and feeble. Somebody's cast into prison and just lays there, they become weak and feeble. Or if somebody has a bad illness, they can be said to be languishing. Well, here he says, the world languisheth and fadeth away, and the haughty people of the earth do languish. And this could be referring even to their captivity, to the time in which they would be in a prison-like state, becoming weak and feeble as a people, and not allowed to prosper and to develop as a nation should. The earth also is defiled under the inhabitants thereof. Now here this word earth seems to be talking about the actual land itself. Not just the people, not just the nation, but the land itself. He says it also is defiled under the inhabitants. Now this could be in one of two ways. It could mean that the earth, because it had produced such a corrupt people, such a wicked nation, would then be counted as defiled because it brought forth such bad fruit. Or it could mean that because the practices and habits of these people were in such conflict with what God wanted, that the very ground upon which they stood, the very earth upon which they lived and made their existence, was defiled because they were on it. Now that's a pretty graphic description whenever you start talking about the earth being defiled because of whoever's on it. And he tells why they brought this defilement upon the earth. Because they have transgressed the laws, changed the ordinance, broken the everlasting covenant. Now this is the reason the earth was defiled. This is the reason nothing was the Lord wanted it, is because they had transgressed the laws. Now, to transgress a law simply means to break it, to violate it. Whatever God's laws had said, whatever they desired the people to do, they had violated the laws. And then he says they have changed the ordinance. And this ordinance is a very similar phrase to the word for laws, except an ordinance is the same word here is statute, and it means to take a hammer and a chisel and to chisel something out, you know, in stone, so that it's a permanent rule or law or practice. And they change this, and we see here two ways that people can violate what God wants to have done. One is, they can let his laws stand as they are supposed to stand and just not obey them. They can recognize it. Well, this is his law. He wants me not to steal. He wants me not to lie. He wants me not to take his name in vain, you know, whatever the laws are. I recognize that it's God's law, but I am not going to do it. I'm going to transgress the law. That's one way. Another way is to change the ordinance. You say, God says that you should not steal, but we're going to reword that. And it says you shouldn't steal unless you're hungry. You shouldn't steal unless it's something that you can justify, that the outcome would be better or beneficial more so than the not stealing would be. You've changed his law then. Now, you know, man can change God's laws. God doesn't change his law, maybe, but man changes the law. And man can believe that it's been changed. He can be taught that it's been changed. He can practice like it's been changed. But nevertheless, God didn't change it. And so here again, would put you in the very same class that these Israelites were in. These people in Judea, they were in a position ready to be overcome by catastrophe. They were in a position in which they were going to be captured and hauled away into captivity, hauled out of their homeland, their homes, their possessions, their goods, all left behind in utter desolation and carried away as a bunch of slaves. And that's how God felt about them, because they had transgressed his laws or because they had changed the statutes. Either way. Now, where do we go to today to find the statutes? To find those things that are chiseled out in stone, or those laws that he's laid down for us? Well, we go to the Bible, and in particular, the church would look to the New Testament. Of course, we're not studying New Testament now in Isaiah. We're studying Old Testament. But the principles of the Old Testament, of course, do apply to the New. And so this is where we go to find his laws and his statutes. And if we see something that God has laid down as a law, and it's compatible with all the other scriptures, there's no way that we can see that God has changed it or doesn't expect us to do it or live by it, and we don't do it, then we transgressed. Or we decided we're going to interpret it in a different way. We're just going to put a modernistic interpretation. You know, this Bible, it's kind of old fogey. It doesn't meet with the modernistic standards of the day. And so we're going to change it around, and we're going to become a lot more loose in our living habits. Then we've changed it. Either way, we put ourselves in the same condition that those Jews were in just before they were destroyed. Such a bad condition that he says the earth is defiled under the inhabitants thereof. How would you like to look so bad in the eyes of God that the very ground that you walked upon was defiled because of you? That's the position they were in. And why? Because they transgressed the laws and because they changed the statutes. That's why. Then he says, thirdly, that they've broken the everlasting covenant. And it's a little difficult to know what he means here by the everlasting covenant. Some of the Bible scholars think that it means that they have broken the laws of nature. The word covenant here means law. And there are certain laws that are natural laws for people that all cultures and all societies recognize as natural laws just seem to be a part of God's patriarchal law. And they'd even broken that. They'd broken the everlasting covenant, the laws that would never change. Now, God has changed his laws, you know. We started out with the law of the patriarchs, and then these people of Israel were given the law of Moses, and now we have in the last days the law of the New Testament, that is the law of the church, Christianity. God has changed his laws, but if man doesn't recognize what the change is, and he goes about and arbitrarily changes to suit himself, then he's going to be in the same position here as somebody who would defile the very ground that supports him because of this displeasing act that he's done before God. Verse 6, therefore hath the curse devoured the earth, and they that dwell therein are desolate. Therefore the inhabitants of the earth are burned, and few men left. This word for burned here is probably figurative. It doesn't mean that they have been literally burned, but it means that they have been so destroyed or so involved in the wrath of God that they can be described as having been burned. In 2 Kings 24, verses 14 and 15, there is a statement made that I think is very applicable here when he says, and few men left. Now, you know, we've been reading here like there's not going to be anybody at all left. But he really teaches that there will be a very small remnant left in the land of Judea even after the captivity. And he carried away all Jerusalem. It's 2 Kings 24:14. And he carried away all Jerusalem and all the princes and all the mighty men of valor, even 10,000 captives and all the craftsmen and smiths. None remained save the poorest sort of the people of the land. All that were left were the poorest sort of the people. Anybody that had a skill or a craft or that was of any kind of prominence, like Daniel and his fellows,